Good morning, and welcome to the Physics 114 lecture for February 16th, 2010. Well, it's morning for me, at least. I'm sitting in the Fermilab high-rise. If you go to the slides that you'll find on the website that are posted under the February 16th lecture, you can see a picture on slide one on the upper left-hand side. There's a picture of the Fermilab high-rise, one of the coolest buildings in the world. It is the primary building at the Fermi National Accelerator Lab, where our high-energy physics group is running an experiment where I'm collecting data right now. Below that, you can see an aerial view where you can barely see the Fermilab high-rise, and it's a bit dwarfed by the footprint of the accelerators that you can see at the site, and they are circular, and we will talk a lot about how you can take charged particle beams and why you would make them go in circles and how you would do that. By far and away, the coolest site I've seen, though, is on the lower right-hand side of slide one, which was looks to be a levitating coyote. It was very cool. I had to take a picture. At any rate, down to business. I hope things are going well. Let me see. Let me give you an update. My TAs say they have graded the exams. I took a quick look at the grades. The mean for the exam was about 62. It may change a little because there are a handful of exams at LAS that haven't been picked up and graded. 62 is not that unusual for one of my exams. It's maybe a touch low, but it's in the reasonable range. I need to look over the exams, which I plan to do when I return before class on Thursday. If they look reasonable, if the grading looks reasonable, then I'll hand them back on Thursday. If I feel that the TAs were a bit harsh and we want to regrade some things, then I'll request that they do that. And if I do that, unfortunately, it will delay the return. If they were a bit lenient, I won't ask for a regrade. So if there is a delay, trust me, it will work in your favor. But that's what's going on with the exam. So if you would proceed to slide two, I'd like to remind you what we talked about last time on the Tuesday before your exam. We were discussing capacitance. So in any physical situation, if you have charge, the potential that is around that charge is proportional to how much charge is there. Remember that if I say that the potential is zero at infinity and I'm bringing a little test charge in from infinity, if I'm bringing it in toward a big charge, then the potential in the space near that charge, that is how much work it takes to bring that little positive charge in from infinity, will depend on how much charge is in that space. So we call this constant of proportionality the capacitance. It's actually typically used to discuss configurations of conductors. So, for example, parallel plates, where you separate charge between the plates, and then we talk about the potential difference between the plates, and the potential difference being how much work it takes to take charge from one plate to the other. And because if I put much more charge on the plates, then the electric field between the plates is much greater, and it takes more work to move from one plate to the other, which means the potential is increased. So again, the potential is proportional to the charge on the plates, and that constant of proportionality is, again, this quantity that we call capacitance. It is horrible that capacitance, I mean, the constant, the symbol that we use for capacitance, is a C, which is a highly overused symbol in physics, but it is the obvious one to choose for capacitance because the word starts with a C. Oh well, so we're sort of stuck with that. So in the middle left of slide two, you can see the basic relationship that defines capacitance, which is that the charge is equal to the capacitance times the voltage. So Q equals CV is a relationship that is very important, and you want to remember it and use it all the time. The units of capacitance will be the units of charge over the units of voltage. So that's coulombs divided by remember that voltage is work per unit charge, so that'd be a coulomb divided by newtons times meters divided by coulombs. So you end up with coulombs squared over newtons meters. And this has been named the farad by physicists. So get used to that. A farad is actually an anomalously huge amount of capacitance. So what you will often run into are microfarads and millifarads and things like that. Those will be the more common units that you'll see, or the most more common sizes of capacitance that you'll run into. So let's see. Another thing about capacitance is that it depends only on the geometry of the system. So it doesn't matter what situation you put a capacitor in or a particular thing, how much charge you can hold for a given potential difference across the terminals depends on the geometry of that capacitor. We did an example where we looked at a parallel plate geometry, and you can see the relationship we found on the bottom right of slide 2. We found that the capacitance is equal to epsilon naught, which is the permittivity of free space, times the area of the plates divided by the distance between the plates. So you'll note that when I say it depends only on geometry, I mean, what I really mean is that when you calculate what the capacitance depends on, it depends only on constants and things that depend on the geometry of the plate, the area, the distance between them, etc. So if you will proceed to slide 3, we found also last time that the relationship between capacitors in parallel or in series. So certainly circuits and other things can be made of multiple capacitors or in the most general case, the capacitors can be arranged in both a parallel or series configuration, or some mix between the two. If you understand the relationship of how to define the total capacitance for a system if the capacitors are arranged in series, and if you know the relationship that tells you the total capacitance if the capacitors are defined in parallel, then between the two of those relationships, you can take any geometry and break it down into series and parallel situations and mathematically figure out what the capacitance of the system happens to be. So if you look at the upper half of slide 3, imagine taking capacitors and putting them in a parallel system, in a parallel situation. So what do I mean by that? It means each of them is hooked across the same the wires, which are held at the potential VAB. So imagine putting it across a battery or something that holds the conductors, which are shown by the wires at point A and at point B, holds them at a particular potential difference across one another, and then you hook the three capacitors each across that potential difference. And since the capacitors, the leads to the capacitors are also conductors, what you're really doing is putting the same voltage across each of the three capacitors. So that means the charge in the system basically gets spread out amongst all three capacitors. So if I now ask what is the total capacitance of the C1, C2, C3 system, what we find is that the total capacitance, C sub tot, is equal to the sum of the capacitances. And we derived that at the end of class last time. You can see it in the notes for, I believe it was February 9th. If we take the capacitors and put them in series, so if you look at the bottom half of slide 3, if the voltage is across the points A, B, and now if a charge were to move from A to B, it would basically have to go through each of the capacitors. This is a configuration where you can imagine this is something which we call capacitors in series. So the way to think about a series situation is if you would imagine a pipe. In a series situation, the water has to go through the pipe. And if you have three regions in the pipe, water passing through the pipe has to go through each of the three. A parallel situation would be like a pipe that splits into three and then comes back together. So water, or in this case charge, that moves through the system could take one of the three paths. So that's what you mean by parallel. So you have to, generally it's pretty easy to tell. Sometimes there are circuit diagrams where it's really difficult to sort of tell whether you're dealing with a series or parallel situation. At any rate, in the series system at the bottom of page 3, you can get the total capacitance by the relationship that is on the lower right. 1 over C tot is equal to the sum of the 1 over C sub I's. So if we go to slide 4. Now I've got a question for you. This is what I would do this with the PRS system in Hoyt Hall if I could. But let's try to do it here. Suppose you have three identical capacitors which are connected in the two different configurations that I show. On the left-hand side, you have configuration 1, where the three capacitors, each with individual capacitance C, are hooked up in series, and to the right, they're hooked up in parallel. Let's suppose that in both cases, 1 and 2, I apply a voltage across this configuration, which I will call V sub AB, and we're going to allow some time to pass so that the charge flows and the capacitors get fully charged so that we now have a static situation. My question to you is, how does the amount of charge stored in the left-hand configuration compare to that on the right? I'm going to give you a minute to think about this, and I want you to think about it and tell me what you think. Okay, so if you go to slide 5, if you haven't thought about the problem, you really need to pause this recording and think about the problem, otherwise it doesn't do you much good. So if we go to slide 6, in order to do this problem, in order to think about how much charge is stored in each of the systems, you need to think about the system as one capacitor, which means the amount of charge is proportional to the voltage across the box, and how much charge gets stored depends on the capacitance. So you need to evaluate the total capacitance for configuration 1 and compare it to that for configuration 2. And since the total charge is proportional to the total capacitance, the situation where you have the larger charge will be the same situation where you have the larger potential difference. I'm sorry, the larger capacitance. So on the left-hand side in configuration 1, the charge Q1, total charge stored in configuration 1, is equal to the total capacitance in configuration 1 times VAB. Since it is a situation where the capacitors are in series, you can evaluate C1 tot using the relationship which is next to the second to the bottom on the left-hand corner of slide 6. 1 over C1 tot is equal to 1 over C plus 1 over C plus 1 over C. So C1 tot is equal to C being the capacitance of each of the individual capacitors divided by 3. If you look at the capacitance, to determine the capacitance for configuration 2, we say that the charge in configuration 2 is equal to the total capacitance in configuration 2 times VAB. And in this case, because the capacitors are in parallel, the capacitance is just the sum of the three capacitors, so that's 3C. So C1 tot is clearly going to be less than C2 tot, so that means that the charge stored in configuration 1 will be less than the charge stored in configuration 2. So I hope that makes sense. Unfortunately, I can't ask for questions and the such, but so be it. You can always ask either via email or when we have class on Thursday. So proceed to slide 7. There's a question that I would like to address, which is, imagine that we have a capacitor. So we have this diagram written on slide 7, and on the right-hand side is a capacitor, which we'll say has capacitance C. And let's say that it is initially uncharged, and we then hook it across an EMF, which holds a potential difference, V, across the capacitor. Okay? And at T equals 0, so we're going to say at T equals 0, we connect a capacitor across the EMF. Now what I'd really like to do is to try to figure out how much work is done to charge the capacitor. And what I mean by charge is to take, the capacitor initially has no charge on it, and then I put a potential difference across it, and what that means is that charge will flow until the capacitor basically has enough charge on it that the electric field in the opposite direction grows enough to keep charge from flowing anymore. So that means that you'll deposit a bunch of charge on the capacitor until you reach a static situation. So imagine hooking this battery, potential V, across the capacitor. What will actually happen? Well, the potential difference, the whole idea of the battery is to hold its two terminals at a particular potential difference. Okay? It does that by basically putting positive charge on one and negative charge on the other. So if I have a bunch of positive charge on the battery and I hook it via conductor to this capacitive parallel plate thing, then the charge is going to flow from the battery to the conductor. Remember that conductors, the E field is zero in a static situation. So if you have charge sitting at one point on a conductor, it will spread out until you have an electric field of zero. And so at the moment, at T equals zero, the electric field in this conductor is not zero, and the charges will flow until it becomes zero. So let's ask, I'd like to examine this process so that we can calculate how much energy it takes to charge the capacitor or how much work it takes. So at T equals zero, you can imagine a little differential charge begins to flow toward the capacitor, but it's just charge flowing through a conductor, and it's not flowing toward any charge because there's no charge yet on the capacitor. So it basically takes no work to move the charge through the capacitor, through the conductor at that point. Now let's go to slide 8. Imagine that the differential Q1, the first little bit of charge, has been moved to the capacitor, and now it's sitting on the capacitor. And now you ask, how much work does it take to move the second little bit of charge? So this would be at time 0 plus delta T, so a little differential time after the capacitor begins to charge. So you have a little bit of charge already on the capacitor. And the question is, how much work does it take to move the second little bit of charge all the way to the capacitor? Now the work is going to be non-zero because the battery basically has to move the charge against the repelling force of the charge that's already sitting on the capacitor. So it's going to take a little work to dump more charge on the capacitor. As the charge on the capacitor grows, it takes more and more work to move additional charge to the capacitor. So if we think about what's happening at a general time t during the charging of the capacitor, we have the situation which I've sketched at the bottom half of page 8, where we can imagine that a little bit of additional charge, we'll call it dq prime, is being moved by the battery to the capacitor, which already has a charge Q prime across it. Now, the potential of the battery is fixed. It is V, as you see on the left-hand side. As the charge across the capacitor grows, the potential difference across the capacitor grows. And that relationship is always given by Q is equal to CV, or in this case, because we're dealing with a Q prime, which is on the capacitor, the Q prime is equal to CV prime. So this is it. Remember, the capacitor is not fully charged yet. This is some general situation during the charging of the capacitor, so it's partially charged with Q prime, and the potential difference across it is V prime. And the relationship, because the capacitance depends only on the geometry, the relationship is still given by Q equals CV. So, in this situation, let's ask let's define the potential at the positive plate to be zero, just for the EMF. Okay, let's do that so that the potential difference can be treated as an absolute here. So we then ask, if the potential is defined to be zero at the positive plate of the EMF, how much work does it take to move little dq prime all the way over to a plate where the potential is V prime? And the amount of work, remember the potential in this case is the work per unit charge, so the amount of work, the V prime that it takes, the potential difference, which is V prime minus V, but I've defined V to be zero in this particular problem. So we have V prime is equal to the amount of work it takes to move the charge across divided by the amount of charge I'm moving. So V prime is equal to dW over dQ prime. And I can now move the dQ prime over, and we have that the differential amount of work it takes to move little charge dQ goes as V prime times dQ prime. So that's the equation on the lower right-hand side of page 8. Let's go to page 9. So if we build on that equation, the amount of work it takes is V prime times dQ prime. I want to rewrite V prime in terms of Q and C using Q is equal to CV. So dW is equal to Q prime over C times dQ prime. And now I have basically a differential relationship that I can integrate. So the total amount of work it takes to charge the capacitor to its final charge, big Q, where big Q is equal to C times V, where V is the potential across the battery, is the sum of all these little differential works, bits of work that it takes to move each differential piece of charge over to the capacitor. So I now integrate the right-hand side of the relation, the second relationship on page 9, and I get that the total work is equal to the integral from 0 to the total charge of Q prime over C dQ. I'm integrating charge. The integral of Q dQ is going to be Q squared over 2. And I evaluate that between the limits of Q and 0. So I end up with the total work being Q squared over 2C. This is the total work it takes to deposit the charge on the capacitor. So that, remember that work and energy are basically the same thing. So the energy it takes to charge a capacitor is equal to Q squared over 2C. I can use the relationship Q is equal to CV to write the energy required to charge a capacitor in a couple of different forms. And so encircled in red near the bottom of page 9, you see the three different forms that I can use to describe the energy that's required to charge a capacitor: Q squared over 2C, or 1/2 CV squared, or 1/2 QV. In all honesty, the one that I remember is 1/2 CV squared. I'm not quite sure why. Maybe it's a little bit like 1/2 MV squared or whatever, but that's the one that sticks in my mind. And then the other two I always can get using Q is equal to CV. So I hear you say, Professor Manley, this is really exciting, But why do I need three different expressions for the same thing? Well, if you look at the three different expressions, you'll note that the left-hand one involves Q and C, but not the potential. The middle one involves C and the potential, but not the charge. And the right-hand one involves the charge and the potential, but has nothing to do with capacitance. Well, I won't say it has nothing to do with capacitance. It means that you're not using the capacitance. So that means that depending on what you're given in a problem, you may find one form or the other to be the particularly useful form to use. So this is the work required. It's the energy. Rather than call it E or E sub C or whatever, usually it's given the symbol U. So U is equal to 1/2 CV squared. Again, we like to throw out additional symbols just to make life difficult. So let's proceed to slide 10. Now, if I have a charged capacitor, if you think about it, I have these two parallel plates and I've deposited a bunch of charge on them. So I have positive charge on one side and negative charge on the other, and say in the upper right-hand corner of slide 10. You have clearly created this electric field in the given volume. And in fact, we have looked at the electric field configuration for parallel plates, and we found that outside of the parallel plate configuration, the electric field is zero, and inside is equal to sigma over epsilon, if I recall. So the question I have is, if it takes a bunch of energy to establish this situation, where does all that energy go once you've charged the capacitor? And the answer to that is what you've really done is you've established this electric field in the region between the plates. In the process of dumping the charge on the capacitor, that electric field gets stronger and stronger. So a way to think about this is that what you're really doing as you charge a capacitor is you're doing work to establish the electric field inside that capacitor. Or you could say that capacitors really store energy in the form of an electric field. So when we were initially talking about capacitors, you may have noticed I was struggling a little bit trying to figure out how best to introduce them. Capacitors are a way, they're sometimes looked at as a reservoir of charge in a circuit. That's true. They're also a place where energy gets stored in a circuit in the form of an electric field. So if we look at it in that former sense, that what we do with the capacitor is store energy in the form of an electric field, then it makes sense to ask, what is the energy density in that electric field? And the energy density, which is generally given by sort of a script U, is going to be defined as the total energy stored in the capacitor divided by the volume between the plates. So let's proceed to slide 11. So if I define on the upper left the energy density, script U, is equal to the energy divided by the volume between the plates, that's going to be the total energy divided by the area of the plates times the distance between them. And we've already determined that the energy it takes to charge the capacitor goes as 1/2 CV squared. In the second row on slide 11, you may also recall that we derived the capacitance of a parallel plate system to be epsilon naught times A over D. So if we put these expressions together on the third line on page 11, in the middle, the script U, which is the energy density in the electric field, is equal to the total energy 1/2 CV squared divided by the area times the distance. We can rewrite this by substituting in epsilon A over D for the capacitance, which is in the numerator of that expression. And then we do a little bit of algebra, and we'll cancel out the areas, and what we find is that the energy density goes as epsilon naught over 2 times v squared over d squared. But what is v squared over d squared? Well, remember that we define potential as the work per charge to move a charge from one plate to the other, and the work goes as the force times the distance, and the force is going to be q times e. So we're going to make use of the relationship that we can derive using that thinking, which is that the electric field in the parallel plate capacitor system is V over D, and we have derived that. So if we just use it here, then we find that the energy density goes as epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. Remember that electric field is constant in the system. So I can rewrite that as epsilon naught over 2 times E squared, where I get rid of the vector symbol and I don't have to put the absolute value marks because I'm not using the vector symbol anymore. So the E squared, as I have written it in the right hand bit of the middle equation on slide 11, just means magnitude. Hold on a second, because I'm making a modification in the slide. Okay. So we have the relationship. We've derived the relationship that we have in the red box at the bottom of slide 11, which is that the energy density goes as epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. But notice, we started out with this very particular geometry, which basically is simple and we can understand it, which is this parallel plate geometry. But in the end, what we derived was an energy density for an electric field, and the final equation has nothing to do that is specific to the parallel plate system. We just get the epsilon naught over 2 times the magnitude of the electric field squared. So what we have derived is a very general statement that there is an energy density in an electric field no matter what is the geometry, whether it is a transient electric field or not. At any given instant, the energy density stored in that electric field goes as epsilon naught over 2 times E squared. So if we want to determine how much energy is stored in a system that has an electric field in it, all we have to do is to figure out that magnitude of the electric field, and basically knowing the volume, we can then calculate the total energy. So this is very important, right? If you're a power company, or if you want to know how much energy it takes to power up a circuit, or etc., you really need to know this. And in fact, we'll find there's other places where this comes in, which are even vastly cooler. But I'm not going to talk about it yet because I don't want to ruin the punchline for later lectures. At any rate, in the box at the bottom of slide 11 is something that you will definitely want to know and definitely want on your next formula sheet, although admittedly I'll probably put it on the formula sheet that accompanies your test. The energy density goes epsilon naught over 2 times magnitude of the electric field squared. And this is truly an awesome expression that has lots of really cool implications. So one of the things that we can do with this, for example, I can imagine having a system, a configuration of charge which happens to have an electric field, etc. And now, not only can I ask you what is the electric field in the system, I could ask you how much energy is stored in the system. So on slide 12, I have a very particular example. Let us suppose that I have two conducting shells, one which has a small radius A, and one has a larger radius B. And on the inner one, I place a charge plus Q, and on the outer one, I place a charge minus Q. And by now, you should be able to use Gauss's law to determine the electric field everywhere. And when you do, you should be able to convince yourself that the electric field is zero inside of a radius A, so that is inside the inner shell, and the electric field should be zero where for radii greater than little b. so outside of the system. But in between the two shells, there's a region of a non-zero electric field. And you should be able to use Gauss's law to convince yourself that from the symmetry of the problem, it should be radially outward, excuse me, and that the electric field magnitude as a function of R, where R is between is greater than a little a and smaller than little b, will be equal to K times Q over R, and it'll be radially outward. If I now were to ask you how much energy is stored in this system, you can think of this as a capacitor. This is like a spherical capacitor instead of a parallel plate capacitor. What is the total energy stored in the configuration? Well, it will be the integral over the volume where there is an electric field of the energy density. So it'll be the integral over the total volume of the energy density times dV. It's a spherically symmetric problem, so the differential volume that you want to use is 4 pi r squared dr, and you now substitute in for the energy density and integrate from little r equal little a to r equal little b. Why r equal little a to r equal little b? Because that's the only region where there is a non-zero electric field. So the r squareds actually cancel, and you have a bunch of constants that you can pull outside of the integral, epsilon naught over 2 k squared times q squared times 4 pi, and then you basically have the integral of dr evaluated between the limits of b and a, which gives you the b minus a in the expression at the bottom. So the total energy stored in this capacitor is equal to epsilon naught over 2 times k squared q squared 4 pi times b minus a. I can now give you any configuration of charge where you might need to then figure out the electric field and then be able to calculate the total energy stored in that system. So let's now go to slide 13. All right, hold on. Let's go back to slide 11. All right, so we're going to take a break. Now, we've sort of covered electrostatics, more or less. We've talked about how to determine the electric field. If you know the electric field, you can determine the forces on various particles. And we've now also evaluated how to determine the energy in a system. The potential gives us ways to determine how the energy of a charge changes or how much work it takes to move a charge around a different system. So we've actually done quite a bit. And this gives us enough ammunition to do basic electric circuits, because we now have sources of potential difference or batteries. We can hook batteries across conductors and the such and capacitors and figure out how charge will flow. So we'll come back to this in a minute, because we really do want to talk about the flowing of the charges themselves or the electric current in the circuits. But before we do, I want to, let's go to slide 13. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the electric field in materials. You can say electric fields in materials, but because it's important to make things as confusing as possible, you don't want to just say that. You want to say the same thing, but you'd like to be able to say it in different ways, some of which sound like words that no one else knows about. So a physicist will usually say these are electric fields in dielectrics. So a non-conducting material or an insulating material is something which physicists call dielectrics. So picture in your mind the rubbery stuff around a conducting wire on a cable that you plug into the wall, for example. Or picture acrylic or glass as a dielectric, water as a dielectric, oil as a dielectric. Whatever the material is, a very important one for most of you is water, and water with certain ions mixed in it. Okay, it might even be somewhat conducting, maybe less conducting than gold wire, for example, But these types of dielectrics, water and water with different types of ions mixed in, are the types of dielectrics that are really important if you want to understand electric effects in solution or chemistry or dogs. So this is really important stuff for you guys. Okay. So if we're going to talk about electric fields and materials, we're going to talk about two different types of materials. On the left-hand side, we have what I'll call polar materials. So these are materials where the basic element of the material is made up of molecules that have a molecules or regions of the material that have a permanent electric dipole. So these should be very familiar to you from chemistry, for example. You can have molecules where you have positive charge concentrate on one side and negative charge sort of concentrate on the other. And these then are inherent dipoles. The other thing you can, okay, now if I have a material which is polar, so I have all of these little inherent dipoles sitting in this material, they will naturally be in a fairly random orientation. There will be some interaction between these dipoles because each of them has a little electric field around it. You can imagine if the material is at room temperature and things like that, that they'll vibrate a little bit, and so they'll have sort of this random orientation. If I now take this polar material and I expose it to an external electric field, then as you can imagine, the positive part of each of the dipoles will be pushed away in the direction of the electric field, while the negative side will be attracted toward the source of the electric field. So there will be a net torque on each. Remember torque, right? Torque is sort of this angular force idea in mechanics. Torque goes as R cross F. I do hope you guys are familiar with the cross product from Physics 113. We'll be doing a whole lot with it soon when we get into magnetic fields. I will review it, but I hope you remember it. At any rate, torque goes as R cross F, where R is the distance from the axis of rotation that the force is applied. And so what basically the way to think about it is that in an electric field, each of these little polar molecules will tend to have a force on it that will cause it to align along the electric field. So that's one type of material. Let's go to the right-hand side of slide 13 and discuss a different type of material. These are nonpolar materials. So you can imagine individual atoms where they are where you have a positive nucleus surrounded by electric charge, which is negative, but it's a symmetric situation so that there is no net electric dipole. Or you can imagine molecules, for example, carbon tetrachloride, for example, where the symmetry is such that you have no net electric dipole. So sodium chloride or hydrochloric acid would be examples of polar molecules. Carbon tetrachloride would be an example of a nonpolar molecule. You've studied all of this ad nauseum in chemistry because the ability of polar and nonpolar molecules to dissolve or dissolve in other substances depends on this polarity. And in fact, At its core, it depends on electrostatics. But at any rate, for nonpolar molecules, on the right-hand side of slide 13, clearly you have no significant electrostatic effects between them because they're all nonpolar. Now, if I apply an electric field, you can imagine that there will be a force on the positive charge and the negative charge, which will separate them slightly. So in the middle of the right-hand half of slide 13, you can see that I have a nonpolar molecule where I am exposing it to an external electric field. And what will happen is that the molecule will become distorted somewhat. So the electron cloud will be attracted to the source of the electric field, and the positive part of the molecule or nucleus will be displaced a little bit along the electric field, and you will actually induce an electric dipole in a nonpolar molecule when you expose it to an electric field. So in the end, whether you start out with polar materials or nonpolar materials, if you expose them to an electric field, you will effectively have polar inherent dipoles that are aligned with the electric field a little bit. So let's go to slide 14. Before I do that, let's go to slide 13 again. So you can imagine also, if I have a stronger electric field, the dipoles will align more in the case of the polar materials, or in the nonpolar materials, I will get a larger and larger induced dipole because I'll force the electric charge to separate more and more. At the extreme, if I go to an extremely large electric field, I'll just rip the molecules or atoms apart, okay? But if I'm not that big, then what I get is I get more and more of the dipoles to align, or I get a larger and larger induced dipoles, which effectively looks like the same thing, where I get more and more of a dipole alignment. In fact, if we now go to slide 14, we're going to talk about linear dielectrics, where the number of little dipoles that get aligned, or the size of the dipole in the case of the nonpolar, the amount of dipole alignment is proportional to the strength of the electric field. Weak electric field, I have very little dipole alignment. Strong electric field, I have a much larger dipole alignment. So you can imagine now, if you go to the left-hand middle of slide 14, you can see in black a parallel plate capacitor with an electric field, which I will call the external electric field, which is moving from the left-hand side, which goes from the left-hand positive charge all the way to the right-hand negative charge. Inside this region of constant external electric field, we're going to place the pink material, which I will say is a linear dielectric. It doesn't actually matter whether it's a polar material originally or a nonpolar material originally. It's a linear dielectric. So what this means is, either way, you can imagine having these little dipoles that align in the external electric field. So if you look in the pink region, so now on the left-hand side of slide 14, actually let me simplify things. If you look where I have an orange big A at the bottom left-hand side of page 14, we're going to look at a differential little tube through the material. And you have all these little dipoles that are going to align due to the external field. And they will align preferentially with the negative piece toward the positive charge of the external field, and the positive charges toward the negative side of the external electric field. And what you're going to see with all these little aligned dipoles is that in the middle, you sort of have all these positives and negatives aligned near each other, so there's no net separation of charge in the middle. But on the outer edges, so where the orange A is, for example, you'll note I have a negative charge, and on the other end of that little tube, I have a positive charge. So what happens is, when I take this linear dielectric and I put it in an external field, it's as if I'm separating the charge inside the linear dielectric a little bit. But the separation is not as complete as it is for a conductor. Remember, in a conductor, I will separate charge inside until the electric field induced inside the conductor cancels out the external electric field completely, and I have zero electric field in a conductor. What happens with this linear dielectric is that I will get a partial cancellation of that electric field. So depending on how strong, on what type of dielectric it is, whether it's easy to induce the dipoles or not, or easy to align the dipoles or not, I will cancel some fraction of the electric field inside the linear dielectric. So if you go to the bottom right of page 14, we have our external electric field, and then you can imagine, having put in the pink linear dielectric, I get an induced electric field, which is in the opposite direction because of the way the dipoles all align, and that induced electric field is not strong enough to fully cancel the electric field inside the linear dielectric, but it will reduce it. So what happens is I have an external electric field that, as it penetrates into the linear dielectric material, you can that the electric field basically is weakened because the external field adds vectorially with the induced field in the opposite direction, which cancels it out to some extent. So let's go to slide 15. So here I'm basically going to repeat it. The induced electric field, remember, is proportional to the external electric field in a linear dielectric. It's proportional because the alignment of the dipoles is proportional to the strength of the external electric field. So what will happen is that we have the black parallel plate capacitor that creates an external electric field, and then inside the material we have what we'll call the induced electric field, and the total electric field is the vector sum of these two. The induced electric field will never be as strong as the, or is not as, unless it's a conductor, is not as strong as the external field. And it depends very much on the material as to how strong the induced electric field is. So if we go to slide 16, the total field, which is given in orange, inside the dielectric is weaker than the external electric field given in black, provided by the black parallel plates, which are on the outside of the configuration. Excuse me, I've got burps, and I'm sure that sounds horrible to you. On page 16, I have the black parallel plates with charge that provide the external electric field, which is given in by the black arrows. Then inside the dielectric, which is in pink, you see that the field is weaker because that field is the vector sum of the strong external field and the somewhat weaker and in opposite direction induced electric field. How weak that field is, or to how strong the induced field is, the degree to which that material can cancel out the electric field depends on the material. So different materials have a different ability of canceling out this external field. We quantify that by something called the dielectric constant. So if you go to the bottom left-hand side of slide 16, you can see an important relationship, which is that the electric field inside a material is equal to the external electric field divided by a constant called the dielectric constant, which is greater than 1. And it depends on the material. It depends on how polarizable the material is, or how easy it is to orient the inherent dipoles that are already in the material. Engineers and chemists, etc., make tables of different dielectric constants. You will not be doing that, but you will have to use those tables. So different materials affect the electric field strength differently. You can imagine if you're doing the biology of very particular things happening around proteins or around cell walls or around whatever, you're going to need to know the dielectric constant of the materials you're dealing with, because that tells you how the electric field propagates in the material, if you want to think about it that way. So if we go to slide 17, the dielectric constant is greater than 1. That is a statement that the electric field gets weakened as it enters the material because it's canceled out by the polarizability of the material. Just to give you some idea of different substances, the dielectric constant for air is 1.00054, which means air really doesn't affect electric fields very much. The dielectric constant for water, on the other hand, which is pretty important for you, is 80. You know that water is, one, very polar material, and two, because it's a liquid, it's pretty easy to rotate those little poles. So water affects electric fields to a great extent. Vacuum, the dielectric constant is equal to 1. Okay. Oil, the dielectric constant is 4.5. So what does this mean? If I have now in the bottom half of slide 17, imagine having an electric field between two plates, having a parallel plate capacitor, but now instead of having a vacuum there, you fill it full of a material. You can now ask, what is the electric field in that region? If we consider the external field of the parallel plates, that is, as if there were a vacuum there, then we know what the electric field is. The electric field, which I now am calling E sub 0 in the equation where I have a blue large case A circled, we know that that's equal to sigma over epsilon naught. Remember that epsilon naught is called the permittivity of free space. If we now ask, what is the electric field if I put a substance of dielectric constant K in between those plates, we know that the electric field gets reduced by strength by that factor K. So that would mean that the electric field between those plates is now sigma over K, or kappa, I guess it is, times epsilon naught. Well, just to make sure that everyone is thoroughly confused, we define the quantity kappa times epsilon naught as epsilon, or the permittivity. So kappa times the permittivity of free space is defined as epsilon, or the permittivity. So in the equation where we have the circled large case B in blue, the electric field inside that material is sigma over epsilon. So it's the same formulation as we had when we had a vacuum there, but now instead of using the permittivity of free space, we use the permittivity of the material. Note that at the bottom of page 17, we have the permittivity is defined as kappa times the permittivity of free space. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between kappa and the permittivity, but they are different numbers because they differ by the constant permittivity of free space. You may find in a chemistry book, a physics book, or a table developed by engineers, you may find the electric characteristics of a material given in a table of dielectric constants, kappa, or you may find it given in terms of permittivity. So you may, the basic idea is the same, but you have to know which constant you're dealing with to know how to deal with it. And in this class, you'll need to be able to go back and forth. And that is as far as I wanted to go for this lecture. These lectures tend to go faster in terms of material because we don't take breaks doing demos, don't get questions, etc. I hope it hasn't been too boring. I'm doing this in the morning and haven't probably had enough coffee to make this a lot of fun. At any rate, I hope you all have a good week, and I will see you Thursday. I'll try to get this posted today and send out email about how to access it and everything. Thank you for listening, and have a good day.